So today is Saturday, November 17th, 2018. This is part 12 of a Grand Canyon Oral History Series with Robert Bob Cornelius, C-O-R-N-E-L-I-U-S. And my name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning. May we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. We had talked just before we started this interview about an event with a helicopter in Grand Canyon, and I was thinking, I don't think we had that on the prior interviews. Would you mind telling me that story again?
Sure. Yeah, we've done so many interviews. I'm getting a little bit lost in my head too, but what we've talked about, what we haven't. But yes, there was an incident, and I'm trying to think, probably around 1971, 72, somewhere in there, where a helicopter flew through the telephone line that went across the Colorado River, the emergency phone line that went from the South Rim all the way up to Cottonwood, and it crossed the river just downstream from Bright Angel Creek and the Silver Bridge a little ways, and this helicopter flew through there somehow the helicopter didn't crash or anything, but it knocked the line down, obviously. And so it took, I guess it was probably several weeks to a month to get that phone line replaced. And they did it with a helicopter. They strung it back across and reattached it and everything. And but during the period of time when we didn't have any phone service down there, I was the total communications for the Phantom Ranch Inner Canyon area. There was no emergency phones. You know, if people had got sick on the trail or something like that, the only way you found out about it was if someone came into Phantom Ranch or Indian Gardens or Cottonwood and reported it.
Okay.
And so that was kind of a difficult time. And then the ranch manager, his name was Bill Shelton, S-H-E-L-T-O-N, he would come down a couple times a week and get on the radio. I had a base station on top of the refrigerator in the ranger station there, and he would order steaks and potatoes and extra pies and all the different things they needed at the ranch. And I think later on, that went on for a short period of time, and then they got some kind of radio system up at the ranch, like I don't know if they used a CB radio or just what, but they were able to communicate somehow. Probably someone went out on the rim at
right.
a certain time, and they,
right.
they communicated back and forth. So they had kind of a hybrid system there that they used, because he was getting Bill was probably in his mid to late 60s, and his legs didn't work like they used to, and he was getting tired of the walk. It was about 3/4 of a mile from the ranch, or half mile maybe, down to the ranger station where the radio was. So
okay.
he was getting tired of that. So I think that's why they did it that way. And
so the helicopter that hit the cable, or hit the phone line, was that a park ship, or was? Do you know what?
I don't remember. I think it was probably the Jet Ranger that they had there at the time.
And that would have been new. They had Halverson helicopters.
It might have been a construction helicopter.
Okay.
Could have been a construction helicopter. It was somebody that probably was more likely was a construction helicopter, someone that wasn't familiar with that there was a phone line down there, or a new pilot with the park ship or something.
And then did they put a orange ball hanging near there so that pilots could know there was a flight hazard?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
No, there's nothing like that there. It's pretty invisible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's been moved down now, isn't it? I mean, there's not. I don't know that there's cables are still swinging across the.
You know, I don't know what
Can you
their
imagine?
what the phone system is like now
Yeah.
there. The other thing that happened after this is they had a couple of guys from what was called Mountain Bell at the time, Southwest Mountain Bell. They got on mules. And they had a Fred Harvey guide actually at that time. He brought them down to Phantom where they met with me, and then they repaired that phone line. They were there. They were just two guys, you know. They were like old cowboys, and they had been all over Arizona, you
Wow.
know, rural Arizona,
Huh.
for years, doing this type of work, and had used horses and mules. And so then I guided them up the North Kaibab Trail. We checked all that phone line, and I worked with them, and they came down once or twice more to kind of spruce up the phone line, because one of the things that was happening down there is that the system was so old that they had the old turquoise glass insulators on the poles,
Yeah.
and people would steal those because they were kind of like antiques, you know.
Yeah.
I was going around to antique stores in Flagstaff and seeing turquoise insulators down there, and I got to think, well, that's why those are disappearing. The other thing is people would take rocks and throw at them and break them. And the worst place was right in the narrowest part of the Bright Angel Canyon, where near the, I guess it was the second bridge. I think it's the second bridge up, and it gets really, really narrow there. And the phone line went from the east side across the creek to the west side, and it was a really long span. And if someone busted an insulator there, and it happened at least two or three times, the copper phone line would flip across the other three lines, and it would knock the system out, see.
It was short
And
out,
so that
yeah.
had to be repaired fairly quickly. Well, I think the first time that happened, we called the phone company, and these two guys came back down, and we located what the problem was, and we repaired it. But then they got tired of coming down there, or decided it just wasn't economically feasible, and they weren't going to do it anymore. And so their last trip down there, I was away from the ranger station when they left, and I came back, and here's this box on the front porch of the ranger station with about 30 or 40 glass insulators in it. So they had turned their job over to me,
Wow.
and at least that aspect of it.
Yeah.
And a couple of times I had to go up, and that one place was really, really bad. Like I said, because the line would flip over and it'd be way over against the creek, so
Oh, wow.
I had a lariat, and I was able to tie it on to the I'd tie it onto the phone line, and then I'd be able to get some place to put the rope around, and I'd pull on it and tie it off, you know, and get it back in position. And you kind of got zapped too while you were. Well, you're messing with the line, you'd get this little tingly electrical charge, which was very uncomfortable. And so it was really difficult to do that, to get that back up, you know, up over the other lines and the right way, and around the insulator. So it became one other unusual ranger job that you did down there. That's
Add
fun, you know.
lineman
Yeah,
to
I would
your
add
resume
lineman
there.
for the
Yeah.
Park.
Yeah. Very cool. You know,
Yeah.
we were in the end of part 11. We had talked about kind of wrapping up your time in Dinosaur and heading off to Glen Canyon. But we also talked about the image consciousness of the park, and especially as that related to handling administratively infractions that might occur.
Right,
Can you talk to
right.
that a little bit?
Yeah, I think the first time that I remember this coming up, I think it probably came up a number of times at the Grand Canyon, but I don't remember any specific incidents there that affected me. You know, I was a part of a very small little group of people down in the canyon, and I know there was a lot of drama going on the South Rim, but I wasn't really involved in that. But at Dinosaur, I had an incident where I was in the boat shop, which was in the maintenance yard at near Dinosaur, Colorado there, and I walked across and started to go into, there were three bays. There was a bay that had the fire cache, and then there was a bay that had, the four bays, and then there was a bay that had a lift for where they could work on vehicles. Then there was a large bay that had all of the carpentry equipment and that sort of thing in it. And then the fourth bay, and this is going east to west, or west to east, was the river boats, and they'd park the dump truck and stuff in there. And so I was in there working, and this one guy came into the bay, and he saw me working in there, and he kind of did a 180 and went back out, or a 360 and went back out. And he did that, I think, twice over about an hour's period. And I thought something's very peculiar about this. And I knew who the guy was. He was one that we suspected of poaching wildlife up on Blue Mountain, between the headquarters and Harper's Corner, the 25-mile road there.
Yeah.
It's just a right-of-way over most of that distance. And and he was a local kid from Dinosaur that they routinely hired seasonally every year, but it was off-season. He was not working. He was like, visiting. So I thought, well, this is peculiar. So I went over to the dump truck, and I got inside the dump truck and started looking around, and behind the seat I found a 30-06 rifle with a scope on it. And I thought, well, that's kind of unusual, as I would. So I pulled the rifle out of there, and then I paraded through the carpentry shop where all the guys were having their morning coffee about 10 o'clock, you know, they're having their break, and took this rifle and went straight over to the administration building and went into the superintendent's office and said, look what I found in the back of the dump truck in the maintenance yard. And so we unloaded the rifle and on the superintendent's desk, and then I asked him, you know, do you want me to write him a ticket of some kind? He said, no, we'll handle this administratively. Well, the superintendent took possession of the rifle, and there were two guys that were really involved in this. What they were doing was taking the dump truck, going up on the mountain, and shooting coyotes or rabbits or that, you know, whatever they could shoot, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing this on, the one man was doing it on duty because he was driving the dump truck. The other guy was just going along as a ride-along rider. He was the gunman, I guess. And so the permanent employee was really worried he was going to lose his job, I know. And the other kid, well, I think he was probably just banned from the park for the time being. And the park, I suspect, all they did was put a nasty gram in the guy's file, because I don't know of any suspensions or anything else that took place. But, you know, I really wasn't aware of the final outcome of that. I didn't ask.
Mm-hmm.
It was being handled, you know.
Right.
I was the one that found the stuff, but I wasn't really the one that was doing any of the punishing, you know.
Uh-huh.
So that was a that was one case I had. There was one at Kurakani where a very similar one where a guy, he was a boat mechanic, and he came down to Cimarron, which is about 20-30 miles from the headquarters. And as he left, he took a route up along the mountain, and he shot a rabbit. And the way I found out about it is I went into the shop. My office was someplace else, but I happened to go into the shop to get something, and I went into to use the bathroom, and there was blood in the sink of the bathroom. The bathroom sink had blood all in it. And I thought, what's this? Looked around, I could see some rabbit hair. Well, I put two and two together, and I called up to headquarters and talked to the district ranger up there, and I said, Mario is coming up there, and I said he was shooting rabbits down here on duty in the park truck, and you know, if you can confront him when he gets there to the office or to the maintenance yard, you know, he needs to be dealt with. Well, word got out that you know, this had happened somehow, and so they didn't want anybody to, you know, didn't want him to be get a ticket or anything. And again, I don't know what the end result was of that. You know, if anything occurred as far as any kind of punishment or anything like that. So little things like that kind of stick in your craw a little bit, because you feel like there should be a little bit more justice than just administrative stuff. And then the other thing the Park Service did that was, well, now this happened at Grand Canyon a lot, I know, is if someone screwed up, as they'd say, my old boss used to say, if you want to get ahead, screw up. And what he meant by that is, if you make a mistake and it embarrasses the park, or it makes the superintendent angry or whatever, they may give you a choice, you know, retire or move. So, you know, that's one of the things that could happen. Or they would just transfer people to less desirable parks. You know, they used to talk about, well, that guy's going to go to Toosie-Goot, you know. And I had one boss at Kurakani who got this message, and they sent him to Death Valley. He went out to Death Valley, and he looked it over and came back and said, I think I'll retire.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And there were a couple at Grand Canyon where there was one of the rangers there got, I think he discharged a weapon when he wasn't supposed to at a cat.
Right. You told us that story.
I think I talked about that one.
Yeah.
He ended up at Saguaro where he wanted to go anyway.
Right.
So.
Right. So sometimes it could all work out. But
yeah, it could. It's not always a bad thing.
Yeah.
And,
So. Well, it's good to have some sort of mechanism where if things aren't going right, there's a way to deal with it. You know, it's not the normal normal route of, well, here's a ticket, and yeah.
Yeah, and I think it probably works out, you know, it keeps the park from being embarrassed, I suppose, but I always said, you know, our worst enemies ourselves, because a lot of people were doing, you know, would do things that the public couldn't do, and even do some of it, even criminal, you know, so.
Mm, yeah. So how was it that you found Dinosaur, a place you wanted to leave? And this is a remote park. It's an incredible geographical area with a river, with a couple rivers and some river running involved.
Mm-hmm.
And
Sure. Dinosaur was my favorite park. It was favorite place I ever worked.
Oh my gosh, okay.
And I left there because I was a park technician. The Park Service had different series of employees. They had park aides, they had park technicians, they had park rangers, and so on and so forth, and different series. And I started as a park technician. The park technician series was developed to have people that sometimes were local or people that spent a long time in an area, knew the area very well, and the theory was we'd have these lower graded employees, and when the park rangers came in, who were going to be the park managers, they would have some sort of base of knowledge that they could tap into in the form of these park technicians.
Okay.
And the park technicians could do the normal, you know, grunt work day to day. And there were some rules with them. They didn't let people transfer between regions, and you were kind of like you were going to be in this park, you know, your rest of your life. I mean, that was kind of the theory.
And some people would actually like that. I mean, local people who say, well, I got my mom and dad, my family, I've already always lived here, so I'm going to work at this park for my career.
That's right.
Okay. And they would be then resources for the more transitory, I'm going to come in for a couple of years and then move out, and I'm going to use this person
right.
as a resource because they know the place.
Right. That's part of it. But it didn't take into advantage. It didn't take into account human nature.
Ah.
And human nature is, I want to advance in my career, and I want to go other places, and I want to make more money, and all these things.
Yep.
And so what people did, the park technician series for a while was kind of a backdoor into the Park Service to become permanent. And there were always these jobs around, you know, jailers at Yosemite, for example.
Right.
Guides at Carlsbad Caverns and so on and so forth. You heard about these positions that people would get permanent status. Then after they got status, they could become a permanent employee. And so didn't take into account human nature, as I just said. Anyway, Dinosaur, I was a technician, and I was thinking, well, you know, I think I was a GS-7 park technician running the river program there. And I decided when the superintendent made the offer, well, you know, I love Dinosaur, but I don't want to stay here the rest of my life as a GS-7. So I got this opportunity to go to this park ranger intake program at Glen Canyon. Was assigned, they had a mentor down there that I would spend some time with, and of course he would check with other supervisors and see what type of job I was doing and that sort of thing. And eventually I got, you know, full park ranger status, and so that's what I moved there for. It was a career move to Glen Canyon, and really Glen Canyon was probably the last place in the Park Service I wanted to go, because I had been there prior to the filling of the reservoir, and I just didn't know if I wanted to go back and see that area that had been, you know, drowned by the lake.
Right.
I knew that was so beautiful. So that was a really difficult move for me from that standpoint. But there were other things.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to jump in here.
Yes.
And just to clarify, you'd been working now for the Park Service for, I kind of want to say 5 or 6 years, maybe, and you were still a seasonal.
When I was a seasonal at Grand Canyon for about a year and a half, for about 2 years, and then what happened is they reorganized the park. They went from the old system to a park manager system. And this was in, let's see, when would that have been? 1971, I guess, 70. And so when they did that, they took the permanent employee, Ken Hulick, out of the Inner Canyon and replaced him with myself, who was a seasonal ranger, and a couple other seasonal rangers. So they did away with a permanent position, and then they moved it up to the South Rim as a manager. And so I was a seasonal for a couple of years, and then I became a permanent park technician at Grand Canyon.
So a seasonal is seasonal, and a technician is an annual position then?
Right, it's
but
a permanent
it's not,
position.
Oh, it is a permanent position. Okay.
It was a permanent position. But then I moved to Dinosaur as a park technician. And that, because that's the way the position was described. And then I moved from Dinosaur to Glen Canyon then and became a park ranger.
Okay.
The series.
So for you, this move then would be a way to actually have a ladder to climb financially and in a position framework?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Yeah, just trying to clarify that. All right.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were talking
about
it was
a selfish move.
Well, it was a move to a place you weren't necessarily keen on going, especially since
That's
you'd
right.
seen Glen Canyon before the reservoir impoundment behind
That's
it.
Right.
But it was a career move. Okay.
Right, right. And philosophically, I guess I just had to say to myself the whole time I was there, well, you know, we have what we have now. It's a beautiful lake. It still is beautiful, regardless of whether a lot of the beauty is drowned underneath. It's still a beautiful place, and it's a different place. You know, you had a few river runners going down the Colorado River through Glen Canyon, and now you got a lot of people enjoying it. You know,
okay.
And so there was a, you know, philosophically you could make that little leap, I guess, and I pretty much had to.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So where were you assigned then at Glen Canyon?
Well, I had an assignment was at Walhweep, which is at the area at down by Glen Canyon Dam within the park there. And then we had tours. We would go on a 10-4 schedule, just like I did at Grand Canyon. You'd work 10 days. You'd be off for 4 days. And during that time, I would go up to Rainbow Bridge, and the Rainbow Marina at that time was back up in Forbidden Canyon and a couple miles off of the main lake up that arm toward Rainbow Bridge.
Uh-huh.
And the marina was tied into the cliffs with a cable system, so the marina floated independently there in the middle of this bay. And was subject to a lot of waves and stuff by boats passing. That was always a problem. Wakeless speed was something that we dealt with continually there at Rainbow Bridge. But I had a house at Walhweep. I had a houseboat at Rainbow that Rainbow I would stay at.
Okay.
But, I'd pay rent on the house. And what that's kind of an interesting thing too about the Park Service is when I first joined the Park Service, rent on housing was extraordinarily cheap in retrospect. It didn't seem like at the time because I started out making $2.37 an hour or 36 cents an hour. And then by the time all the taxes were taken out and everything, you know, you'd get a couple $100 a pay period, or a two-week period, and then they would take your rent out. But the rent was only like 15. I think the one-bedroom house I had on the South Rim was like $15 a month,
okay,
or a pay period, $30 a month. Then if you used more than a certain amount of electricity or fuel oil or that type of thing, they might charge you extra for that. But I didn't pay for the ranger station down at the bottom of the canyon. they wanted to do that at one time. They wanted to charge me, and they actually wanted me to move down, you know, full time down at Phantom. And I think they wanted to do that, but my supervisor didn't think it was a good idea. Emotionally, for somebody to be down there all, you know, 365 days a year. So
interesting.
When I moved to Glen Canyon, they had a. And one of the other things is, in the U.S. tax code, there's a thing called required occupancy. So all the rent that you would pay for your quarters, you could then write off of your income taxes.
Ah.
And so everybody in the park, from administrative officer, superintendent, secretary, everybody had required occupancy. And started to do away with that by the time I got to Glen Canyon, they decided that, well, you know, the administrative officer doesn't have to be on call, you know, he's just, or some of these other people. And so we're going to take away that benefit. And then also we're going to do a comparability study to see, how much houses in Page or other communities rent for.
Right.
And then we're gonna have that that is a kind of a base for the park housing, and then we will take percentages off for, like, how far it is to the hospital or how far it is to town to get groceries, or isolation, you know, different isolation factors, or, you know, those types of things. So they would reduce your rent and come up with some kind of formula, and that would be your pay. So the amount I paid at Glen Canyon was several hundred dollars a pay period, rather than you know, what I'd been paying at Dinosaur and at Grand Canyon. And it was a really big hit in the pocketbook. And so what people started doing was buying houses. They thought, well, shoot, I'll just go buy a house if I pay this much money, and I will then gain some equity. When,
yes,
I get ready to leave, I can sell the house. And it required, it started making people stay longer, I think, in parks too, because now,
okay,
if you own a house,
yep.
you're kind of tied to the community. You can't just jump up and sell a house overnight. I think they had a program where they would buy the house from you. And
so I'm gonna head off on a little tangent here and ask you.
Yes.
When you buy a house, you, for equity, you buy into a community, and your next door neighbor is the town owns a pizza store, and the neighbor on the other side of you works for the post office, and it's a great way for the Park Service to embed itself in the local community.
Right.
Was there any kind of thought about that as well? I mean, that kind of stuff just happens.
I think that must have, yeah, that probably came into play a little bit, you know. The other aspect of it is that you're not living next to your supervisor or other people.
Okay, right.
In the park, I think it enriches people's lives to be part of a community. Now, some communities don't like the government very well, so
sure,
you have to be kind of, you know, there's ups and downs with that also.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yep.
You know, larger community, when I moved to Montrose, you know, it was a fairly large town, you know, at the time, and I was just another person, you know.
Right.
Nobody knew what I did unless I wore my uniform home, which I usually did, but
mm-hmm.
if they, you know, didn't see me, they didn't know who I was, you know, as a neighbor necessarily.
Right, they'd see you at the supermarket and oh, there's Bob. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. So,
and
I'm also thinking, as you got into the ranger intake program at Glen Canyon, that could have been a pay raise from Dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
So the rent was higher, but
pardon me.
I went
from a GS-7 to a GS-9.
Okay, so the rent was higher, but we were paid more, so it was kind of a wash.
Yes, I was paid more, so that was the one of the big advantages. But then they took it all away when they with the rent.
Right.
Basically, so my standard of living didn't change a whole heck of a lot.
Right.
Or it didn't feel like it did, you know. And but I had a very nice house at both at Dinosaur and at Glen Canyon.
Uh-huh.
And the one at Glen Canyon was out by the Walweep Marina, set up on the hill above the marina.
Okay.
And you know, you'd hear the PA system of the marina all the time down there. They were always calling somebody, you know, what was the guy's name? Mayo Wyatt. I heard his name. I don't know how many times he was a boat mechanic. They were always calling this guy. So
oh my gosh.
I heard him over and over and over.
Is that Mayo?
Yeah, just like
the mayonnaise.
You know?
Okay. Mayo yeah. Wyatt.
Mayo Wyatt was his name, and I remember hearing him all the time, you know, hearing his name over the PA system there. But Glen Canyon was a much different place than Dinosaur. Dinosaur was kind of laid back and quiet, and Glen Canyon, there was always something going on.
Like what?
So there were lots of medical emergencies. There were the drunks in the lounge at the Walweep Lodge. There were boat fires. We had some monumental boat fires there. There were speeders out on the Lakeshore Drive. There were kids that were leaving trash all over the place out at various places around the park, you know. but it was really just a super busy place. You couldn't, and from that standpoint, it was really good for my career because I learned a great deal there. I mean, it wasn't just taking a first aid class. You ended up having to give first aid quite often there.
Okay.
And we had, I think boat fires were probably the thing that were the most surprising. You know, I'd never seen anything like this. They usually started at the fuel dock. And,
oops.
You know, you have a nice hot day, not a lot of wind, and the vapors from the gas get into the bilges of the boats.
Okay.
And the operator doesn't use his blower and doesn't get the fumes out, and he turns the engine on and the ignition, and there's a spark, and all of a sudden you've got a boat on fire. We had one there one time at Walweep where the one of the things that the guys would do they were trained at the fuel station, is if a boat caught on fire, you cut the ropes or untie the ropes and you push the boat away from the fuel dock so you don't have a huge explosion. Well, on this particular night, the boat started, there was just a slight wind, and it started to drift over toward the main marina.
To the other boats.
To the other boats, and it went right into a slip right next to a couple of, you know, I don't know, they were $100,000 boats easily or more. And so we had a Park Service dock that was right below our maintenance building on the, I guess it'd be the west side of the bay, the little bay there where the main marina was for the Walweep. And we had a couple of several patrol boats there. And we went down and we had these, we had grappling hooks with ropes. And we also took, we had a guy there named Eldon Coleman, C-O-H-L-M-A-N. He was the acting district ranger. He was a pretty smart guy. And he had come up with a plan, because the marina, as the lake goes up and down, the marina had to be moved. And sometimes it'd be right up next to the shore, and sometimes it'd be quite a ways out from the shore. And when it got quite a ways out, firefighting was difficult. You couldn't just bring the fire truck down and run hundreds and hundreds of feet of hose out. And so what we decided is we could hook on to a fire hydrant. There was one near the base of the ramp there. And you could use the boat then as a means of delivering the hose. And we'd put the hose back in the boat, and we would go over toward the fire
and reel out the hose.
And then they charge the hose, and then you've got a 2.5-inch hose line that you can put a lot of water on a fire with. And so that's what we did on that particular night. And I think we also had a little pump that was called a waterous pump that you was like a plastic donut that had a gas engine in the middle, and then the hose came out one side of it, and you kind of tow it behind your boat, and this little portable pump would pump water on the fire. So I think we used that that night, because there were actually a couple of boat fires at the Walwheat Marina, and one was at night and one was kind of during the day. And I know we did this stringing the hose at least twice there.
So and, let me just back up a minute. This is a houseboat that probably has a flammable fiberglass hull and sides and roof, and it is full of fuel, which is why it was at the dock in the first place. And now it's...
Well, this was a regular boat this one instance.
Oh, this wasn't a houseboat. This is a regular speedboat.
It wasn't a houseboat,
type.
But they are made of fiberglass, and they melt and burn very hot, and they're hard to put out. And
they're full of fuel.
They're full of fuel, too. Yeah, so you could have secondary explosions.
Right. I was heading in that direction, which is, wait a minute, there's a very flammable hull with basically a couple hundred gallons of fuel on board. Now what?
Well, what we did in this case was try to cool the fire down, get somebody out there to cut the lines, and then push the boats back away from the marina. And it was probably a miracle that on these the marina was saved on a couple of occasions here. So. And then Rainbow Marina was even, you know, was isolated 40 miles up lake from Walweep, and they had a standpipe system we had a 40 horsepower pump for pumping water, and it would really pump a lot of water.
Okay.
And they had these hose reels on the Rainbow Marina. Eventually they got those down at Walweep, because it was pretty obvious that, you know, you might end up in a situation where you didn't have enough people to even, man of any kind of firefighting capability there at Walweep at any one time. So it was better to have something on the docks that they could then fight the fire more immediately than having to wait for the hose to be laid out and everything.
But how would you turn on the pump? I mean, basically, it's a reel on the side of a building with a bunch of hose on it. Was there like a button you'd push next to it that would send an electrical signal over and fire up?
I forget what the system was now.
All right.
I know they could turn it on. I don't remember if we had to, if it was done remotely or if you had to go down to the building and turn the pump on, but I think it was probably done remotely.
Okay.
And the first boat fire I ever had was on Memorial Day up at Rainbow Marina. And this guy went into the fuel dock and he started his boat, and there was this explosion. I remember I was right out on the dock and I heard this boom, you know, and I saw the cowling over the engine go flying way up in the air, and it landed back down in the boat. And guys at the fuel dock, they pushed the boat away from the marina, but the way the wind was blowing everything, it kept blowing back toward the marina. And I got in my patrol boat and got out there, and I had a grappling hook, and I threw this, I was about myself. I threw the grappling hook, and the guy's still on the boat. I mean, he was, oh, no, let's see. We finally got him to jump off the boat into the water, and someone picked him up because he was going to stay with that boat to the last.
Wow.
And someone got him to jump into the lake. They picked him up and took him away from the boat. And then I went up to the boat, and I threw this grappling hook over the bow rail. It had a bow rail on it. And I took off, and, of course, I was kind of in a big panic myself because this thing is really, I mean, there's smoke going, like, clear up over the cliffs, 500-600 feet in the air. And I gunned the boat a little bit and tore the bow rail off.
Oops.
And so that, yeah, that was an oops situation. So I made another pass, and fortunately this boat had a hatch on the bow, and I dropped the grappling hook into that hatch and was able to start pulling the boat out. Well, we knew about this explosion problem, and so we had 300 feet of line in the boat, and I let all that line out and started slowly pulling that boat out, and it got about halfway out in the middle of the marina there, and it exploded, and there was debris falling all over the, I had a cover over my boat, you know, over the, where you sit and everything,
uh-huh.
And stuff was hitting that and cascading off, and I'm lucky it didn't set my boat on fire, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I pulled the boat out of the bay there over to, what do we call that? No Name Canyon, I guess. It was a little canyon between the main arm of the lake and where the Rainbow Marina was. And it was kind of a little hook-armed little bay. And I took it back in there and got it to a position where it would just sink right near the shore, so it was still semi out of the water, and then went back and you know, did the investigation and everything. And we had several others, the same type of thing, where boats blew up, and probably the worst fire at Rainbow I wasn't there for, and it was a guy named Wayne Landrum. Landrum. He was the Lee's Ferry ranger, and he came up for a pay period, and I think I was either on vacation or I stayed down at Wahweap or something, and he spelled me up at Rainbow Marina.
Okay.
And they had a fuel tanker that they would transfer fuel from down at Wahweap up lake to, it was a regular seagoing oil tanker. And I don't know, it must have been 40 foot long or something. And so it would bring the fuel up, and then they would transfer the fuel, use pumps to transfer the fuel off of that into the floating fuel tanks that they had for the public use.
Uh-huh.
And they did this, especially in the summer, they're going all the time.
You know,
back and forth up lake. And so the boat was tied up next to the marina, kind of in back of the store and stuff. And all of a sudden, it caught fire. And poor Wayne, he was able to get there and I guess get water on this and get this thing pushed away from the marina. I don't know what all the firefighting went, but it burned part of the marina, as I recall, and it was, you know, really a bad situation. This was kind of a weird situation, and several years later, after I'd left Glen Canyon, I was talking to somebody who'd worked at a park up in South Dakota, I think maybe Roosevelt or one of those places.
Okay.
And oddly, the name of the manager of the Rainbow Marina came up, and we got to talking about this guy, and he had several times they said, at that time he was like a fire control aide or something, and fires would break out near where he was, and he put out a couple of fires all by himself, and or was the first responder, I should say. And then the same individual, and I don't remember his name anymore, he worked down at Mesa Verde, and he was a naturalist. I think he was a naturalist at Mesa Verde. And he reported, this is when, you know, shortly after Ken Patrick was killed, and he reported that someone had jumped out of the brush with a shotgun and blown a hole in his windshield or something. And so this was really odd, you know. I thought this guy's been in some really bad situations, and here he was the manager of the marina at Rainbow, and the marina caught fire. And how odd is that? So I called down to Glen Canyon, and I tried to get a hold of the law enforcement specialist down there. I left him a message, told him what I suspected, and like a lot of things, you know, it was another park, and nobody ever called me back, nobody ever asked any questions or anything. So I'm wondering, you know, whatever happened. I didn't have any, you know, other than just speculation, I didn't really have any evidence that this guy was an arsonist, but it sure seemed like it.
Interesting. Yeah, you really don't think about the troubles with fuel and confined spaces and sparks. And as you say, on a calm day when you're fueling up a boat, and boats typically don't, you know, like your car at the gas station, there's a little hole and there's a nozzle, and you know, you fill that up, and you're not supposed to smoke, and your vehicle's supposed to turn off, and then you cap everything up, you turn the machine off, then you're clear to start your vehicle. If there's a spark, chances of ignition, I mean, we just don't have these kind of explosions at gas stations.
Because the fumes, sometimes you'll see the shadow, and you can see the fumes on the ground, you know?
Yeah.
They're going down, and they're dissipating in the natural air, but at a boat fueling station, they go down into the bilges of the spaces underneath the decking of the boat,
right?
And they get trapped in there,
right?
Or in the bilge of the boat, and that's when the explosions occur. And we didn't have the same problem. I was worried about it at Curacanti, but there the wind's always blowing. You know, it seems like it's and it dissipates that. And, of course, the volume of boats is so much smaller there also. And the deckhands aren't rushed, you know, and they
can
be sure that things
are vented,
are done properly, you know. Yeah. But a place like Rainbow, I think we would have, on a busy weekend, there might be 600 boats come in there.
Wow.
And, I mean, just a huge number of boats. And there will be people waiting out in the bay there for everybody to finish up, so they could get in and get their fueling. I forget how many fuel stations they had. They must have had a half dozen there.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd all be full, you know, and people fueling up.
Yeah, yeah. So another thing, when I think about boats and water and people, are speed, of course. But Glen Canyon, as a geographical area, is pretty twisty and windy. It's not like Lake Mead, where you can have long periods of high rates of speed. Was that a problem as well? People kind of bumping into things that they shouldn't have done?
No, it's a pretty big lake,
and
people get out and go full blast. I remember when I moved to Curacanti, I lived at Elk Creek, which is on Blue Mesa Lake, And I looked out the window of, I was in a trailer, looked out the window like the first or second morning we were there. And I told my wife, I said, you know, something's really odd about this place. And she says, well, what do you mean? I said, well, it's just, it's a lake, but it's different than Lake Powell. And then I said, you know what it is? I said, the boats aren't moving. Everybody's out fishing.
Interesting.
And at Lake Powell, as soon as they hit the end of the wakeless buoys, boy, they're going 100 miles an hour in their boats there. And it's full out. One of the problems that we would address is that people, you know, would pass, I mean, within feet of another boat, full blast, you know. So you did have those types of issues that you were dealing with. And one thing peculiar about Glen Canyon is that there's a state line there, right? Not too far up lake from Walhweep. You go from Arizona to Utah.
That's
right. And the boating laws are different.
Ah.
You don't have to, kids have to wear their life jackets in Utah. They don't have to in Arizona. They just had to have them available at the time.
Ah.
And so there's different rules, you know. You have to have a fishing license for Utah, and you have to have one for Arizona. And so some of the laws were different. I when I was there, the lake was really high. It came about as high as it had ever been. And there was a shortcut. You could go right next to Castle Rock there. They have Walweep Bay and Castle Rock.
Yeah.
And you could shortcut. You didn't have to go way around through Antelope Canyon in that way.
Right.
And so boats would go racing up there. You know, you'd go from Arizona to Utah in a matter of seconds, you know. So it, I had a thing happen at Rainbow Marina, and this is just kind of funny. I was standing on the marina one day, and this woman and her husband and a bunch of kids came into the marina, and none of the kids had life jackets on. And they had, if they were under the age of 12, I think, they had to wear their life jackets all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's really hot, you know, it's like 100 degrees. It seems almost ridiculous, but the law is the law. So I went over to this woman, and I said, I told her, well, you know, I'm sorry, but you've got to have life jackets on your kids all the time. Well, it's hot, and we had a little bit of an argument. She was upset about it, and I said, you know, well, sorry, you know, that's just the way it is. About that time, this houseboat comes into the bay there, and on top of the houseboat are these two women that are just buck naked. And this woman turns to me that I'm talking to about the life jackets, and she says, well, what are you going to do about that? And I said, well, I'll take care of that. And so I walked down. I knew they were coming into the fuel dock. So I walked down to the fuel dock. Well, these two women saw me coming, because I had my Smokey Bear hat on, or mm-hmm. my Ranger uniform on anyway. Didn't have a Smokey Bear hat on, because they would blow off in the Glen Canyon wind. But I went down, and as I was approaching, they got covered up. They put on coveralls, so they still weren't all that covered up, but they were covered up enough that I figured that was good. So I went up to them, and I told them, they were standing up on the railing on the upper deck, and I said, you're going to have to, you know, keep your clothes on while you're in a developed area like this. You know, there's a lot of kids around and stuff. And I talked to the guy that was the captain of the boat, so to speak, and so I thought everything was copacetic, and I walked back down toward the little ranger station area, and it was about halfway down the marina, and I was talking to this man, and about that time this houseboat's coming over. They're going over to the dump station, which is near the ranger station. They'd gone from the fuel dock over there. They're moving over there. And I'm talking to this guy on the dock, and he kind of got this funny look on his face, and then he sort of turned around and walked the other direction, and I turned around, and this woman is standing there, one of these women, and she still has the coveralls on, and she looked at me and she said, "Hi, Mr. Ranger." And I said, "Hi, how are you doing?" She says, "I'm dressed." And I said, "Well, that's good." And she said, "I'm going to pinch you on the ass." And I said, "You're not pinching this ranger on the ass, lady." I said, "You go get on your houseboat." And she called me a couple of names and then walked over toward the houseboat. And so I followed her. And it's just before all of her friends now, they're all up on the railing watching, because I think this was a planned event.
Oh, got it.
And so I walked up and I said, "Don't believe a thing she says." And she turned around and laid into me with all kinds of bad words.
Mm.
So I went, they left the marina and went up toward to Rainbow Bridge. And I thought, I better go up to Rainbow Bridge. So I did. I went up there and I made sure that they were decent up at the bridge, and then came on back down to the marina, you know. So but the stuff like that went on occasionally too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it's hot there in the desert, and you know, it's water.
It's awful.
Yeah, those poor kids, really you awful. Should, you know, put them in life jackets and then throw them in the lake so they can cool off.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It's tough.
I had one where a guy was probably the worst. The thing that got to me the most of all the injuries I saw, there was a group from Salt Lake City, and they had a brand new boat, and they went up one of the side canyons, I don't even remember which one now, up lake from Rainbow, and it was real, like, super, super narrow, and the dad, who was operating this boat for the first time, he meant to put the boat in reverse, but he put it in forward, and on the bow, he had his two-year-old son, who had his legs dangling over the bow of the boat.
Ooh.
And he ran the boat into a cliff, and it broke this little boy's leg, compound fracture of the leg. And they, you know, you'll see these situations where the people are coming into the marina way too fast. If they come in at above wakeless speed, the marina would just buck like a bucking bronco, you know, and these, I see this boat coming in. I mean, it's just roaring in, you know, and I waving my arms and yelling, "Slow down, slow down." They came right up to the marina, and the mother was just in, you know, hysterics, and so we got the little boy off, and out, off the boat. And I put an air splint on his leg,
right,
and straightened his leg as best we could, poor little kid, and put this air, you know, put some dressing on, put an air splint on him, and then I think I took him to Walweep with his mom, I believe. I know I did. I put him in the patrol boat because I figured it'd be faster, and I knew the way, you know.
Right.
And took him down to Walweep, and they air evac'd him down to one of the big hospitals, or I guess took him to Children's Hospital in Salt Lake City, and they were able to save his leg. Hmm. So that was one I followed up on because.
Cool.
And that was a pretty neat deal, and.
Would you ever call a helicopter into Waweep or Bullfrog or other remote places on the lake for that sort of evacuation?
They probably do now. We didn't at the time.
Okay.
I don't remember. I don't remember if they used the park plane for anything like that.
Okay.
I don't remember hardly any helicopter use at Glen Canyon. I know the several years I was there, I only went on a helicopter one time.
Okay.
And that was to, we were just doing an evaluation of moving the marina down to Dangling Rope Canyon.
Okay.
And flying around looking at that.
And the wind never blew there and never blew big boats up against walls and never did things like that, right?
No, the wind was ferocious there on at times.
Right.
And it would go, you know, the heat and the lack of wind was a problem at fuel docks. But when the wind really blew, you got some mega waves out there. The first week I was there, Eldon Coleman grabbed me and said there was a boat in distress out on the Walweep Bay, and they had called in on their CB radio or something. And so we went out into Walweep Bay in our 20-foot Bertram, and boy, it was scary because you would dive down in these big troughs, and the water would come up over the windshield, and it was a scary situation. Mm. I think we went and rescued somebody off of Antelope Island where their boat had either crashed or sunk, something like that. And that was really a common thing. People would have boat trouble or even lose their boat, and they would get stranded on some place along the edge of the lake, on the Slick Rock or Antelope Island, which was more rocky than Slick Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. I remember one couple. I don't know if I mentioned this earlier or not on an earlier people that came in with a Chris Craft, beautiful Chris Craft boat into Rainbow Marina.
No.
And they had restored this boat. It was just spectacular. And they brought it in to the was an outboard boat, brought it into the marina, fueled up, and I went down and I was talking to him.
So this was an outboard. It wasn't one of the Chris Craft inboards like a Speedster or a Runabout, something like that?
Oh, no, it was an inboard. Did I say outboard? No, it was an inboard. It
okay.
Was a,
mahogany.
Was a beautiful thing. Must have been from the 50s or
piano
something.
Piano finish.
Yeah.
Oh,
beautiful.
Dear.
So they take off and they go out in the main channel, and this windstorm came up. And I was at the marina, and this guy comes in and he says, there's a couple of people standing out on the rocks outside of the main channel out there. And so I get in my patrol boat and I go out, and there's this hellacious storm out there, these huge waves. They would get so big that you couldn't turn around. You'd have to go down to where you could find a cove to get in, make your turn, and then come back.
Wow.
To do it safely.
Yeah.
And so here are these two people, and they're out on this slick rock in this little tiny cove, and they had taken on water in this Chris Craft, and the Chris Craft had gone to the bottom, and they had been able to get out and get on the slick rock. And, of course, they were just sick, you know.
Oh,
with,
yeah. Yeah.
With that, you know.
Wow.
Another time up Last Chance Bay, we had a guy come into the office at Walweep, and he told the district ranger that he had lost his boat. The boat had burned, and they had started a little barbecue on the back of the boat, and the barbecue had fallen over somehow. You know, drunkenness does play a part in a lot of things on Glen Canyon, unfortunately. And so the boat had burned up, and it was a big, great big thing, like 28-foot cabin cruiser. So I went up to Last Chance Bay and found the cove where this boat was. And the only thing that I could see was just a little bit of the railing sticking out.
Hmm.
The guy was sick because he had just restored this boat and refurbished it, and he had no insurance on it at all.
Oh.
Total loss, you know.
Wow.
And so that's why he was crying at the ranger office, so we decided.
Yeah, yeah.
lost everything. But it was hardly, you know, we would just have the marina guys come and salvage the stuff if they could. You know,
right.
They, you know, if there's any way, they might tow hull back to or get parts off of it. You know, they might take the engine out of it or something like that as salvage. But a lot of times, if boats caught fire at Lake Powell, they generally went to the bottom.
Right.
You know, reach a certain point where they no longer were able to stay afloat.
Right.
And would go down.
And the motor would, the weight of the engine would just take it down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had a funny thing happen one time. We were in a training session at the Walweep District Ranger office there, out at the lake, and there were about, I don't know, there must have been about a dozen rangers, and we were all in them. There were two FBI agents, and they were giving this training session. You know, it was pretty neat to have FBI agents come and talk. They were always interesting. And the whole group was in there listening very intently, and all of a sudden there was a radio call, something to the effect that there was a boat fire in the harbor, and all the rangers jumped up in unison and ran out the door. And these two FBI agents were just standing there, just dumbfounded. They didn't know what in the world had happened.
Wow.
And we went out and dealt with that. And another time I went into the bathroom, was using the bathroom, and I left my radio out in the lobby of the building, or actually in my office. And when I came out of the bathroom, there was a maintenance man there. And he said, are you guys doing anything about that fire out in the over on Antelope Island?
Oh, my gosh.
And I said, what fire, you know? And I went out, I stuck my head out the door, and here's this big black plume of smoke. And I had left my radio, you know, for 5 minutes to use the restroom, and you got a boat fire. So that's the way it always went at Glen Canyon.
So it sounded like...
I was going to tell you... Oh, go ahead.
Well, it just sounded like it was a much higher visitation park than Dinosaur, combined with water and alcohol and fuel and speed, and a watercraft that people aren't necessarily real conversant in operating. It's a recipe for excitement.
Yeah, it was. It just went on continuously. Yeah, it was continuous.
I
was going to mention one little thing that happened there. We were talking about communications earlier, I think. And
yes.
When I first got to Glen Canyon, they still had the reclamation police in the town of Page. They did all the enforcement of laws. They didn't have a local police department.
Ah.
And it was still a federally run city, basically. Well, that changed. And when that changed, we no longer had radio communications with them.
Oh.
They, you know, like most units, they want to get paid, for their dispatcher.
Yep.
And, you know, that I guess it wasn't budgeted or something. And we ran around for a while there at Glen Canyon with no nighttime dispatch at all. During the day, we had our headquarters, and we had a secretary there that would answer the radio. But at night, there was nothing. Not only that, but they didn't tell us that there was no radio communications. And so that was kind of a sore point. And we had a meeting with the superintendent, Temp Reynolds was his name, and he came out to Walweep because we were all angry about a number of things. And one of them was this radio communications. And I remember telling Temp, I said, you know, I haven't done a car stop for a couple of weeks out there on Lakeshore Drive. I said, because I'm not gonna stop somebody in the middle of the night and not have some kind of communications with somebody.
Yeah.
It's just too dangerous. I'm not going to commit suicide out here.
With no radio backup, sure.
Right, with no radio backup. So he said, well, he thought maybe they could fix that. You know, they'd work on it and blah, blah, blah. And then the other thing was we did have some communications, because we might have one person that would be on call, and but that was usually for nighttime. And what we had in our residences were these red phones that were emergency phones. And if someone dialed a certain, if they dialed the ranger station at night for emergency, the call would be sent to your residence, and then you were expected to be home and answer the call.
So you were off, and, but you were on call.
On call, but we weren't paid anything for that. See, and the chief ranger was out there too, and he said, "Well, how do you know you're on call?" And I said, "Well, because there's a little asterisk by our name when we're on call. That's the way we're doing it." And he said, "Well, that's you know, we're not, we were wanting to get paid for our on call status.
Mm-hmm.
You get up like 15% of your pay grade or something like that." And they, and he said, "No, we're not going to do that." And we said, "Well, okay." So what we started doing at the direction of the district ranger is we would put the, at night, rather than putting the emergency phone on to the ranger residence, we started putting the emergency phone directly to the chief ranger's house or the assistant superintendent's house. And so that was pretty effective. In fact, the first night that we did that, the acting district ranger, Eldon Coleman, he says, "Let's all go to town and have pizza." And so everybody, the entire law enforcement staff, left Wall Wheat and went into Page. And we had a big pizza party. And so we were playing, we were playing kind of a political game with these, with the managers,
mm-hmm,
who
mm-hmm.
had control of the purse strings, to get their attention that, you know, there was some real safety issues there that they needed to address, you know, or they weren't going to have a proper law enforcement out of the park or out of the recreation area.
Yeah.
So
yeah. And so, how
an interesting setup.
I'm assuming that fairly quickly there was a change in that.
Right. They did change, and they did put give a certain amount of on call pay to people, and people would volunteer for it then, you know, rather than have to stay home.
Okay. Yeah.
So that things did change, and we did get radio communications with the city of Page, and then we also, of course, would use their jail there in Page to house the few prisoners that we did arrest. You know, that we had the same problem at Glen Canyon that we had at Dinosaur. You had the state line, and you had no federal judges in Utah. You had Judge Ritter, and that was it. And so we had very poor judicial system. All the cases we wrote were Utah state voting law or game law, and we would tell people that they had to appear before state justice of the peace in where the heck was the one? There was one in Blanding, I think, and there was one in some little weird town up in Utah there.
Yeah, Monticello or gosh, where would it be? Hanksville?
No, I can't remember where that. Well, there was probably one in Hanksville, but I don't remember. There was one really weird one, Mount Carmel Junction or something. I don't
know, that, interesting.
They had this justice of the peace, and there wasn't a lot of follow up on this stuff. You know, I mean, it was all dealt with down at the administration office. We were too busy to follow up on our cases, I guess, or something. The state, the federal, we did use federal system down at Wall Wheat. In fact, we got in trouble for it in that someone gave us the authority to write the ticket and then place an appropriate bond with the violation, And because the bond schedule was so low, and that went on for a little while, and then the chief judge down there found out what was going on and said, "You cannot do that." We were judge and jury it there for a while. But we did also handle things through a justice of the peace there in Page. So there was some, there was law enforcement for, you know, traffic violations and stuff like that that we dealt with a lot. And for other things, like we had some burglary cases we took down there and stuff like that, because there was always somebody stealing from somebody else on payday. People would find the money that they had, you know, cashed, their check would disappear or something. You know, it was usually roommate on roommate, and the roommate that had done the bad deed, you know, disappeared. And
so this would have been the concessions employees at Huawei.
A lot of concessions, yeah. A lot of it was the concession employees. Yeah.
Okay, and so that was similar problems to Grand Canyon. With,
that's
again,
right.
concessions employee issues.
Yeah, you had a real transient group of people. I mean, the people that were there long term, generally you had less troubles with them. It was the transient folks that were just coming through. I know at Grand Canyon Phantom Ranch, for example, we didn't have a lot of law enforcement problems from the people that were down there necessarily, but there was some. But they would be very transient in nature, and they wouldn't. They'd go down there thinking that was going to be a big vacation, and
right.
then they'd work them to death, and
they'd
be gone within a week and a half. Mm. You know? So it was hard to keep enough staff down there, and then they'd burn out the permanent staff they had, so it was a really bad situation.
Right. Okay, we Bob, we have been yik-yakking here happily for about an hour and 20 minutes.
I know.
And I have a ton more questions for you about Glen Canyon.
Okay,
which is good.
Meet again, I guess.
Is there anything else you'd like to add as we wrap up this part 12 interview?
Well, no, I guess I've talked enough.
Okay. Well, this is the end of part 12, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Robert Bob Cornelius. My name is Tom Martin. Today is Saturday, November 17th, 2018. And Bob, thank you very much.
You're welcome.